Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome into another edition of The Sit Down, a crime and mafia podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Nadeau, joined as always by my co-host, our consigliere, our legal expert, our guy, Blackjack Fletcher. What's up, Blackjack? How are you? Another week, another sit down. We're off of a great episode and a well-received episode. How are you doing this week?
I'm doing fantastic. More importantly, the show is doing fantastic. As you mentioned, Jimmy Burke episode, huge episode for us. A lot of traction there. As always, we really appreciate everyone for listening, man.
Yeah. You know, we've done seven episodes so far. And I remember, I think I talked about this in the first episode. When I decided to do this, I'd kind of mentioned to you about it. And I've talked before, last year was the weight loss year. This year was, I'm going to do stuff that I've always wanted to do, whether it's traveling or doing other things or podcasts, you know, passion projects, if you will. And, you know, this has been something that I've had a passion for really forever. Look, I'm not in the mafia. I think sometimes maybe I think I am, but I've always really had, you know, a real interest in it. I've always enjoyed it. I've always loved crime. And I remember I've talked about this before. I remember when I was young, I mean, I wasn't watching, Rugrats and Hey Arnold. I mean, I was watching Sopranos. I was sitting outside of my parents' bedroom watching Sopranos. So I've always enjoyed this stuff. And, I'm glad to see that not only we're doing it, but, you know, it's getting a lot more traction than I thought it would. And, you know, I hope down the road we can do even bigger things. I have a lot of ideas for this. I think it's a huge market, especially with some of the people that I know and some of the things I think we can do. So, you know, I thank everybody for listening. If you're returning for this week's episode, welcome in. Thanks for checking us out. You know, we really try to tell a story here on the show each week. And, you know, we've got so many people to do and it's really been fun. So, we all, Blackjack and I both, have thank you a lot. Look, we obviously got us. We both have some pretty good connections in entertainment. I think we all know that. We don't have to talk about that, but you know, we had some people that we know that happen to like the show. And when they talk about stuff, things go. So shout out to those guys, you know, Dave and Dan, thanks to those guys. That means a lot to me. I like I said, it's a passion project for me. And the fact that, you know, we got so many people to listen to it yesterday made me feel happy. So we got another big episode today, Blackjack, and we have a literal big episode. We're talking about Big Joey Messina, one of the, really a complex guy, a complex and long, really life in the mob. Joey Messina had a long reign as the controller, basically, of the Bonanno crime family. He is probably, and I think you would agree, Blackjack, the last true mafia boss in New York, really after Joe Messina. It's really been kind of a mess of an organization, all five families. Now, all five families are still around, but Joe Messina, once at the top, we'll talk about his highs, his lows, really his incredible finish to his life in the mob. But truly kind of the last Don. And I remember, I believe the Time Magazine or one of those publications called him that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think that when we do these shows and when people think about like a gangster, right? Like, you know, they think about those guys like John Gotti and, you know, we talked about Vincent Gigante in our first episode. You know, they think about these kind of larger than life characters. Joe Messina is the last of that ilk. Like he's the last one. His career spanned significantly longer than most of the guys we've talked about in terms of he went later into modern days more than they did. And there hasn't been anyone like him since, man. I mean, he is the last of a dying breed.
Yeah, he was really the last of the Mohicans, basically. I mean, you had, really in the 80s, obviously the commission case, and then you had, you know, people like Chin Gigante, who kind of got into the 90s, and you had stuff going on out in Chicago with the Family Secrets Trial and those kind of guys. But, you know, in New York, Joe Messina was, and look, like I said, Joe Messina was really one of the main decision makers in the Bonanno crime family, really, since he became involved. And we'll get into that. It was a long reign as the as a high ranking member and as boss long term. And you know, we'll talk about some of the things that he did, I think, to really improve the Bonanno Crabbe family. The Bonannos have always been kind of a messy bunch, really with very little order for a lot of their reign. We obviously remember the Joe Bonanno stuff. They were a group that was kind of loosely connected. There was a lot of things going on. They're one of the only families that was selling drugs at a high level. But the good thing about the Bonannos is they didn't really have a they were kind of a headless group. They didn't have for a while, a boss. And, you know, other bigger than life bosses were kind of taking away the attention from the Bonannos, and they kind of hung out under the veil of law enforcement. But let's get into it. It's a long story, and we'll get into also, obviously, whenever you talk about the Bonanno crime family, you've got to talk about Joe Pistone, Donnie Brasco. We'll talk about that a little bit and really kind of the effect it had on the family as a whole, because it was a major embarrassment. Okay. I mean, really, outside of one or two others, it was the first time, if ever, that a FBI agent was able to, infiltrate a family. And, you know, again, it was pretty embarrassing for a crime family that's had its fair share of embarrassment.
I mean, to say embarrassing is to allow an agent of the government to not only infiltrate your organization, but to do it for as long as he did and as deep as he did,
right,
is virtually unheard of. And I mean, we'll talk about it as the show goes on. It could never happen today.
Right. So let's get into it. Joe Messina on the sit down. Joseph Charles Messina was born January 10th, 1943. He was born in New York City, Maspeth, Queens, to be exact, where he was raised. Maspeth, like a lot of sections in New York in, you know, basically the 40s till today, there are, especially in his time, there are plenty of mob guys running around. Joe was one of three sons to Anthony and Adelaide Messina, who were both from Italy. Joe, it's unclear really most of his life. As far as we know, what we know, Joe Messina's parents were okay people. They weren't involved in the mob as far as, people have let on. Joe would, though, be a problem child really from the beginning. He would become a delinquent by his early teenage years. He would eventually drop out of high school in 10th grade. So, you know, Joe had, I think, obviously we've talked about many people in the show, and, you know, Joe was one of them that didn't have a particularly bad childhood or anything. It wasn't like Jimmy Burke or John Gotti, but, you know, Joe kind of just was one of those kids that was troubled. Weirdly enough, in 1956, at the age of 13, he actually meets his future wife. He meets a woman called Josephine Vital. And look, I'll say this right out of the gate. Joe was smitten. Joe pretty much fell in love right away. And Blackjack, even until, you know, Joe's later years, Joe's demise, which we'll get into, obviously, there's one thing that I will say about Josephine Vitali Messina. She was a beautiful woman. I can understand why Joe would fall for her. Joe had great taste. She was a looker, even into her late years. She was a very attractive woman. Joe, again, fell in love pretty much right away, basically dated her for a couple of years and got hitched and got married in 1960 at the age of 17. Joe was pretty quick to tie the knot. And why not? You meet a good woman, an attractive woman. Sounds like a great situation. And look, that wasn't unheard of in the 50s and 60s to marry that young. I really wanted to tell and talk about this early, because one of the main people in Joe's life, in his criminal life, was Josephine's brother, Salvatore Vitali, Sal, who was an army guy. He moved around in Maspeth. I really took a liking to Joe. Joe and him became obviously very close. They were family. And Joe would indeed, for most of his life, trust Salvatore Vitali. Joe was, a youthful kid, but as he got older and older and into his 20s, he began to gain weight. He was a big cook. He liked to eat. And he gained the name Big Joey. It's unclear how he kind of got into the mob lore. There's no real info that he worked necessarily doing errands or anything like that. But in the 1960s, early 1960s, he meets Philip Rastelli. Now, Philip Rastelli is basically, if you've ever seen A Bronx Tale, he would have been the Sonny of Maspeth. He basically ran Maspeth. Yeah. He was a capo regime at the time. Natalia Vola was the boss of the Bananos, and Philip Rusty Rastelli ran Maspeth. He owned the lunch wagon business, and he sets Joey Messina up with a lunch wagon. Now, again, keep in mind, Rastelli was part of the Workman's Mobile Lunch Association, which, if you read between the lines, it really wasn't much of an association. It was just a racket for protection, yeah. And it allowed people to pay in dues, and it was just kind of kickbacks to people, things like that. And Joey Messina was a cook, so it worked out well. Basically, the lunch truck would frequent union job sites and different job sites and, you know, basically hand out sandwiches and things of that nature. And Blackjack, as we know, with any mob-connected business, there's always going to be other things. And Joe quickly, with no competition, cornered the lunch wagon trade. People liked his food, and they also liked the other things that were going on. Joe basically gets Sal involved. They start running a numbers racket out of the lunch wagon. They start not only doing numbers, but they start bookmaking, and they start giving loans out. Some people, as we know, a lot of factory workers and union people are degenerate gamblers. They start playing the numbers, and it was a really lucrative business for Joe Messina, and that's really kind of the first taste of mob life. It was good to know Philip Rastelli. He ran Maspeth Blackjack.
Yeah. I mean, listen, it was a good entree for him, right? Because you get the backing of Rastelli, which is obviously a huge, huge thing at that point in Messino's very young career. And you think about it, right? This lunch wagon thing is the perfect front to be running numbers and loans out of, because it's a constant string of people coming up. They're always dealing in cash, you know, and nobody's paying a ton of attention to what goes on at the lunch cart. So it really is kind of the perfect front for someone to run those operations out of.
Yeah. By the late 60s, Joe Messina had this fledgling lunch truck business. He had a numbers racket. He was making money, and he was only in his 20s. I mean, keep in mind, he's in his mid 20s at this point. He decides kind of up his coinage a little bit, and he decides to start getting involved in the hijacking business. Now, we've talked about hijacking. We talked about it on last week's episode with Jimmy Burke. John Gotti was a truck hijacker. Back then in Kennedy and different airports, it was very easy to hijack trucks and fence the stolen goods. We all know what are in trucks, Blackjack, sellable opportunities if you can get the goods. So with Sal Vitale and a carjacker he knew called Dwayne Leisenheimer, they start hijacking trucks. And this is where each family had representation at the airports, right? So, yep. The Bananos representation at this point is Joe Messina. The Gambino's behest, John Gotti ran the airports as far as hijacking. That's where Joe Messina meets John Gotti. That would set up a pretty long relationship between those two. Now, obviously, Joe continues to be a very strong earner. He's making and amassing a lot of money. Joe opens his own catering company called J&J Catering, which would act kind of as, you know, what Blackjack a front, right? But Joe Joe was so smart because he really went where his successes were. Joe loved to cook. It was a great business. It was a great front. Who the hell would worry about a lunch truck, right?
I mean, it's like you said, it's a good front because, number one, it's not the traditional mob fronts, right? Like construction, plumbing, stuff like that. Like when you read these stories about guys, catering is not usually a front for, you know, a racket. So it was good. And yeah, he had a total story behind it because he was a good cook and it worked as a legit business. And again, those businesses are great ways to hide money because it's all cash and there's very little, you know, there's very little record of it. It's not like you're dealing with government contracts or things like that.
I mean, Joe is really smart because, you know, when you look at a catering company, what do catering companies do? They basically provide food to parties, right? You can create a lot of fake parties, man.
Sure can.
I mean, You know, it's not difficult, especially in an Italian neighborhood where they celebrate every fucking holiday known to mankind.
I mean, dude, we talked before about like Gigante and like how he got tied up with this gigantic windows contract in New York City.
Yep.
And like, that's a way you get caught, right? Because now there's contracts involved. Government agencies are involved. This is a catering company dealing with, you know, Joe Schmo down the block. There's not going to be any real records of this.
No. And that's kind of the real intelligence of Joe Messina. Joe really just found his lanes really in his early career. By the 70s and early 70s, Joe Messina's mentor, Philip Restelli, was a high-ranking member of the Bonanno crime family. In 1973, the boss, Natalia Vola, dies, and Restelli's basically named boss. The problem for Restelli was, and this is an issue for Philip Restelli's entire life. Philip Restelli was an unlucky man. He spent a lot of time in jail. He really didn't have much time on the street as boss. And the year before, in 1972, he would be convicted of loan sharking and extortion, where he would go to prison. So he was the boss, but he wasn't really able to do too much because he was in jail. And that was pretty much the story for Restelli his entire life. But the good thing about Joe Messina, Joe is a loyal guy. Philip did a lot for Joe, and Joe would always remember that. In 1975, Joe Messina and Salvatore Vitale are basically summoned by Paul Castellano to commit their first hit. Keep in mind, by this point, Joe Messina is not a made member of the Bonanno crime family. He's a soldier in really name only. He's making a lot of money, but you got to put in your work, as they say. Mm-hmm. So Paul Castellano, while he wasn't a violent individual, he was, like most mobsters, very sensitive.
He's a petty guy.
Yes. And Paul Castellano at this point has a daughter, and she's with a guy called Vito Borelli. Vito Borelli starts making disparaging comments about Paul Castellano. Now, it basically started with Paul was always looked at as he's not a street guy. He's a businessman.
CEO.
Yes. And Paul liked that because, again, it was that he made money. But it also got under his skin because this Borelli started comparing him to this guy, Frank Perdue. And at the time in the 70s, Frank Perdue was like a chicken guy. Yeah, he was a chicken guy. He was a shoddy, like, goofy salesman. Like, he was, you know, one of these goofy, like, pitchmen, basically.
He was an Arkansas millionaire, if that puts it into context.
Right. He would, like, appear on things. He'd have, like, a little chicken on his shoulder. Like, he was a real goof. But again, during the 70s and these times, you know, Paul did some business with Frank. And so this Vito Borelli starts, you know, comparing him that he's Frank Perdue and he's a businessman and all that stuff. You know, Paul becomes furious about this and basically tells another family, hey, can you carry this out for me? So with John Gotti, they go to Joe Messina and Salvatale and say, hey, we want you to take care of this. Now, this was good news for Joe because this would mean he can make his bones. He could then move towards becoming a made man in the Bonanno crime family, which he did do. Now, later down the road, it would be proven that Joe Messina and Sal Vitale were the trigger men. Joe would try to pawn this off on Gotti years later, but Joe was indeed the killer.
Yeah. Just think about that for 1 second. John Gotti doing a personal favor for Paul Castellano.
Right. Which, if you remember, not necessarily did John Gotti do that, but John, look, he didn't like Paul, which we've talked about in our shows before when we did John Gotti, but John Gotti did play by the rules. You know, when he was asked by Carlo and Paul to go kill, you know, James McBratney, he did it, mm-hmm. you know, yep. in this situation. But if we remember and we go back to John Gotti, there is no proof has ever killed anyone. There was actual proof. A lot of people thought that he did this Borelli murder, but he did not. It was Joe Messina and Salvatore Vitale. So they've made their bones. They're both on the level. They can both get made now. There were some other things that went on, though, around this time. In 1976, Joe Messina also arranges the murder of a hijacker friend of his called Joseph Pastor. Joseph Pastor was someone that worked with Joe on those truck hijackings. And Joe basically needs $10,000. Which around this time was a lot of money. It's what, $60,000, I think, in this case. So Joe kind of thinks of something very simple. I'm going to borrow the money and then just whack Pastore, because that would be great. He's not alive to come collect his money, so we'll just kill him. So Joe is turning into quite the enforcer as well. And as we've talked about time and time and time again, there are two types of mobsters, and then there's one very good mobster. One mobster is an earner. They make money. Maybe they don't like to get their hands dirty. And then there could be another mobster that loves to kill people, and he's an enforcer, but he might not necessarily make a ton of money. Joe Mussino was like Jimmy Burke. He was both. He was willing to kill. He was willing to order murders, and he made a lot of money for the family. In 1975, Joe's arrested at the scene of a truck hijacking. Basically, Raymond Weem and a few others that were part of the hijacking crew, which Joe was a part of, hijack a truck. Joe basically skates and leaves the scene. He's arrested several hours later, and he's charged with conspiracy to receive stolen goods. Now, he schedules to go on trial in 76. However, the trial charges are dropped after Joe Mussino basically makes up this ridiculous story that he knew the hijackers and were concerned after he was driving on the side of the road and saw them and thought they were in trouble. So he just stopped to help them. And the jury bought it, and he basically beat the rap. So it was kind of a wild story, but Joe Mussino found a way to get out of it. In 1977, this is Joe's big day. Basically, at the age of 34, he's inducted into the Bonanno crime family in a ceremony held by Carmine Galante, who is the acting boss at this point. Him alongside Anthony Spiro, Joseph Chili, and several others, they were all inducted. So Joe's a made man in 1977, by
Yeah, I mean, listen, it was a good time for him, right? Because like you said, in 75, he gets to do the favor for Castellano, which puts him right on track to being a made man. And then he gets this case, you know, with this hijacking thing. And like you said, he comes up with this story. He also wound up not being properly Mirandized by the cops, which was, I mean, back then, it certainly wasn't what it is now. I mean, the Miranda law had only been in effect for less than a decade. And so, you know, he winds up getting off on a technicality and a ridiculously bullshit story. And now he's finally in. And now this is where his career really starts to go to the next level here. He goes from just being kind of an associate to now being on the track towards his ultimate perch at the top of the organization.
Yeah, Joe was on the uptrend for sure. Now, as you know, as usual in the Bonanno crime family, there's a lot of cracks developing. As we said, Joe's mentor Philip Restelli is still in jail, and the acting boss of the family is Carmine Galante. Now, Carmine Galante was a dangerous dude, man. He was a big drug dealer. He was a chilling character. And he was also out of control at this point. Carmine Galante was not only selling drugs, but he was selling drugs, not sharing any profits with other families. Keep in mind, drug dealing was for the most part outlawed. The Bonannos did it. Carmine Galante basically didn't give a fuck. And look, Joe Mussino was loyal to his boss, you know, Philip Restelli. Now, Carmine basically said, fuck him, I'm the boss, and you're going to get in line, basically. Joe worries that Galante is going to kill him. So in typical Joe Mussino intelligent fashion, he goes to Carmine Persico, who is the boss of the Colombo crime family, and Paul Castellano basically says, look, I'm worried. Carmine is out of control, as you know. He's killing people that he's not allowed to kill. He's selling drugs, not sharing the profits. He's got to go. I think he's going to kill me. They basically tell him, look, you got to take care of your business and do it before he does it to you. The hit's approved on 1979. And this is where it's set in motion. So fast forward to July 12th, 1979, Carmine Galante goes to a restaurant called Joe and Mary's. It's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, Italian restaurant. Sits out on the back patio, and gets a nice meal, one of his favorite meals. He's there with two of his associates, and that's when several gunmen blast through the back door and basically kill Galante, Toronto, and Leonard Coppola. They were all killed instantly. And if you remember, this is a fascinating hit because a photojournalist, if you remember Blackjack, gets that great picture of Galante basically in a white polo shirt, basically in a slumped blood, you know, death position with a cigar hanging out of his mouth. That was his trademark. So Joe Messina was smart enough to realize Carmine Galante was a lunatic and he had to get to him before he got to him. So, and that's something that Joe Messina would always be just, it's all, you'd often think about Messina because when we get to how smart he was, you'd have to wonder if Joe Messina would have just went the right way in life. He dropped out of school at, you know, 15, but this guy was smart as a whip, man. He was so much smarter than everyone else. He seemed to always be a step ahead of people.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to put it. He was always a step ahead. And I mean, you see it even in the way he does the hit with Galante, right? Like, he didn't go off half-cocked. And we've seen some guys in, you know, in the episodes we've done go off and do things half-cocked. And then, you know, now you're looking over your shoulder. No, he goes to the commission. He gets approval. And now, you know, within 2 years of being inducted, he goes from soldier to capo within 2 years.
Yeah, and that's something that Ristelli, you know, they always took care of each other. With the hit on Galante and him out of the way, Philip Ristelli can finally, at least he thought, take full control of his family. He was the boss. And by Joe Messina being loyal, he promotes Joe to capo regime. Now, obviously, Joe's making money. And as every big time wise guy does, he goes and gets a social club. They call it JNS Cake. That was for Joe and Sal. And that was right behind J&J Catering. And it was all a massive front. But Joe was slowly but surely leveling up, as they say. You know, he was in like Flint. But as usual, more issues come for Philip Ristelli and Joe Messina. Following the hit on Galante, another group of folks decide that, you know, they want to be boss and there's no boss, so we're going to take over. They were called the Three Capos. That was Alfonso Delicato, Dominic Trinchera, and a guy called Philip Giacone. They were basically all together. They basically decide we're going to jockey for power. Fuck Philip Ristelli. Fuck all those guys. We're going to take over. Philip's not here. And if he's not here, he doesn't get anything. It's almost like you miss school, you miss out. Right. Now, the commission at the time tried to stay out of it. But as Joe Messina figured out from Galante and figured out in this situation, Joe knew that if you weren't part of this boys club, you got to go. And Joe got word that they were stocking up on going to war, basically. So Joe, again, goes to the commission, Persico and Castellano, says, hey, got this problem again. Our family's a fucking mess. What do I do? He decides, okay, we're going to kill them. So Joe and Sonny Black Napolitano, which we'll get into in a bit, he's part of the Bonanno crime family. Him and Messina are compatriots. They basically arrange to meet the Three Capos and basically try to ceasefire this whole thing and figure out a way to get past it. Little did the Three Capos know, Joe is basically setting it up to ambush them. So on May 5th, 1981, basically the, you know, 40-year anniversary just passed from this, Joe sets this hit in motion. So they basically pick a house out, and in several closets in the house, there are multiple shooters, which would include one, Vito Rizzuto, who becomes the boss of the Montreal crime family years later. They would basically ambush these three capos and kill them. They come in the house. The three capos are immediately murdered. But there was another person in the house as well with the three capos, a guy called Frank Lino. He finds a way to get out of the house and escape. And this, again, kind of helps Messino's image. I mean, Messino is trying to right the wrongs of the mess that this family has become. So Joe is earning his prestige. He then has another problem. Frank Lino escapes. What are we going to do about Frank? Frank quickly is won over by Joe Messino. Joe basically says, look, obviously I'm willing to kill them. I'm going to kill you. You're either with us or against us. Get down or lay down. And Frank decides to get down, right?
Only choice to make.
Yes. Now, again, as usual, Joe Messino has problems with his decisions. Basically, Alphonse Sonny Red and Delicato's son, Bruno and Delicato, a.k.a. Anthony and Delicato, who we've talked about before, who's Tommy Patera's mentor, he, like any good son, wants revenge on his father's killer. And this is where the Donnie Brasco situation figures into this whole Borgata. So Sonny Black DiPaolitano is running around with several folks, basically Lefty Guns Ruggiero, Anthony Mira, and this guy called Donnie Brasco. The Donnie was a jewel thief and someone that Anthony Mira brought around as an earner. They start hanging around. Lefty Guns Ruggiero basically starts mentoring Donnie Brasco. And by this point, Donnie's moving around. Donnie is asked to basically kill Bruno and Delicato. And that's where the entire Bonanno crime family has one of the biggest embarrassments in the history of the mob. The FBI informs Dominic Napolitano that Donnie Brasco is actually undercover FBI agent Joe Pistone, and they're informed of his infiltration. At that point, there's actually photos of right after the FBI tells these guys about what happened. And Blackjack, the photos are fascinating because you could see just the complete look of just what the fuck just happened on Dominic Napolitano's face, on Lefty's face, basically on everybody's face. They were blown away that they were used and abused by an FBI agent.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the whole Joe Pistone, Donnie Brasco thing is just, I mean, it's an unbelievable saga when you sit back and really think that they were able to get this guy infiltrated into this family and so deeply into it. I mean, think about the guys we're talking about that he was dealing with, man. I mean, this is not some low level shit. Like, this is as high up as it goes in the Bonanno family at this time. And so for him to be there, and not only that, but I mean, I think it's really hard to say that Joe Pistone didn't have a hand in people getting killed, which if this is 2021, never fucking happens. The FBI would have so much shit to deal with as a result of this. That's why it's such a fascinating incident to me, because it was a once in a lifetime thing that could happen.
Yeah, it really was. And look, I've actually reached out to Joe Pistone. I'm trying to get him some time to come on the show. You know, maybe down the road we can make it happen, but I've always would love to ask him about this kind of stuff. But so basically Joe Messino is by name only. Joe would never say he was the boss at this time, but Joe is basically the boss of the Bonanno crime family. Rustelli was in prison. Rustelli trusted him. And I think even Rustelli would say, look, he's my guy on the street. Joe Messino is furious about this, deeply disturbed by this breach basically in his family. And Salvatore Vitale and him basically say, look, we got to take care of these guys. We can't allow this to just go untouched. We'll be laughed at. We've got to do something about this. And Joe Messino was actually later quoted as saying, I have to give Sonny Black a receipt for the Donnie Brasco situation, yeah. Which was basically a writing on the wall to say that not only he had to go, but others did as well. So on August 17th of that year, in 1981, basically, Dominic Napolitano is summoned to a meeting. And it's been said by associates that Dominic Napolitano actually hands his keys and money to his associates and says, I'm probably not coming back from this. Now, again, I want this to be made very clear. And I will obviously very much admit this. Until Dominic Napolitano's demise, he was Cosa Nostra through and through. He got used. It's just that simple. Yeah. He didn't snitch. He didn't do anything wrong. He just allowed someone that was an outsider.
He had bad judgment.
Yeah. He allowed someone to come in. He took, and it's important to understand, he was not the person that brought Donnie around. That was a guy named Anthony Mira, who was assassinated as well.
I just think there are some things when this is your lifestyle, right? When you are in this life and you have these tools at your disposal, there's just some things that you're just not going to let slide, right? Like we talked in the Gotti episode about John Favara accidentally killing Gotti's son. Total and pure accident, right? No ill will or intention behind it whatsoever. You're just not going to let that go. Like, you're just not going to let it go if you have the tools to do something at your disposal. Same thing here. If you allow an FBI agent to infiltrate the deepest recesses of your family, that's not going to slide.
Yeah, so Anthony Mira was murdered, and Napolitano basically goes to this meeting. He goes to a home. Sonny Black basically knows this is that. He's greeted by a captain called Frank Coppa. He goes down the basement into the meeting room, at least he thinks. He's basically shoved down the stairs and shot. Now, it's been on record as that when he was shot, one of the gunman's guns jammed. And Sonny responds on his knees, basically saying, "You fucking idiots, do it right next time." And they murder him. At that point. It's also said that they cut his hands off to basically signify he shook hands with the wrong person. So he was gone. Now there was one more person to whack, and that was Benjamin Lefty Guns Ruggiero, who was played by Al Pacino in Donnie Brasco, the film, which is very good. One of my favorite mob movies.
Yep.
I think it's important to just kind of put this to bed. I don't know if we'll ever do a show on Lefty, but Lefty was not the character they portray in the movie. He wasn't knocking off parking meters for money and stuff.
No.
Lefty Guns Ruggiero was actually a pretty feared guy. He was a killer, an admitted killer. It was said that he killed up to 25 people. I mean, he was a tough guy. And he was a guy that was old school to the core. Weirdly enough, he was summoned to a meeting at a social club. As he's walking in, the FBI arrest him, which is wild. Yeah. They basically say, "Put your fucking hands up," and they take him in. The FBI has been on record as saying that he's a dead man if he walks into that meeting. Yeah. Now, after that FBI pickup, they put Lefty Guns in protective custody. And Blackjack, again, he is a man on a hit list. They try several times to get him to cooperate, and he says no. He refuses to cooperate, and even at one point tries to bail himself out. But there's good news here. The mob actually says, you know what? This guy's a stand-up guy. He really wasn't someone that actually brought Donnie around. We're going to give him a pass.
That's rare. I don't have to tell you how rare that is, to be marked and then to be given a pass. Although, I mean, you've got to see, you have to admit, if anyone deserves it, man, it's that dude, because you will never find a happier person to be placed under arrest than a guy going to a meeting about to be killed. And can you imagine the set of balls it takes to turn around and say to them, "Go fuck yourself," after that?
Yeah, I will say this till if you ever ask me who are the top five stingiest, realest Cosa Nostra people, really underrated wise, Lefty Guns would be in there for sure. I mean, Lefty Guns is Cosa Nostra to the core. It didn't last long because in 1982, basically the federal government said, "You know what? You're not going to fucking play ball. We save your life. We're going to put you away." Yeah. Ruggiero would down the road get arrested and sentenced to 20 years in prison. It would also be said that when Ruggiero found out about Donnie Brasco, he basically was quoted as saying this: "I swear to God, I'll kill that motherfucking filthy rat bastard piece of shit FBI agent if it's the last thing I do. I'll kill his whole fucking family. That traitorous motherfucker, cheese-eating rat scumbag piece of shit, that fucking coward, cocksucking FBI fuck is dead." In 1992, though, he would be released from prison after serving 11 years. At this point, he had lung and testicular cancer. And in 1994, Lefty Guns would die at the age of 68. So he didn't end up getting to kill Joe Pistone because Joe Pistone is still alive today.
That is a hell of a statement, though. I mean, if you take the FBI agent part of that, it could apply to someone else we know.
Yes, true. Pretty much, though, every bad word in the book, you know, was doled out there. So back to Joe Mussino. So it seems as if Joe Mussino has gotten through all the tough times, right? All the upheaval attempts, the Donnie Brasco situation. Joe Mussino was through the ringer. In 1982, Joe Mussino is tipped off by some Colombo people that he's going to get indicted for some transgressions. Joe basically gets wind of it and escapes to the Pennsylvania mountains. In 1982, he's charged with conspiracy to commit murder against the three capos and truck hijacking. During the hiding, he was able to basically see some lawyers and figure things out. Mobsters would come see him and kind of take care of him. And he was still kind of running the family just in secret. In 1984, Philip Restelli is finally released from prison, and he and Joe Mussino order the murder of a Bonanno capo called Cesar Bonaventure. Now, Cesar Bonaventure was actually at the Galante hit. He was a bodyguard for Galante. He started to play ball and started to become part of the family. But at this point, Joe got sick of Bonaventure. He called him disrespectful. He didn't support him while he was in hiding, and Joe decides he's got to go. Now at this point, Joe's basically the boss, all but a name. So they call Bonaventure to a meeting where he's killed, en route, for that, killing, Joe's brother-in-law, Sal Vitale, is inducted into the Bonanno crime family. So, they're both in. Joe's basically the boss and Sal is a high up, at this point.
Yeah. The note here is if you're called to a meeting in the Bonanno crime family, it's bad news.
Correct. That's pretty much, again, other than you being in good graces, usually when you're called to a meeting, if you're in bad graces, you might want to get out of town, if you will. In 1984, Joe's still in hiding a couple years, but he gets some help through some lawyers and he negotiates his surrender and is released. That year, Joe continues to add to his arsenal. He gets some no-show jobs. And Joe's actually indicted a few more times, including his mentor, Philip Restelli. He gets indicted again. Philip was a unlucky character, man. But he would have to face not only that trial for labor racketeering, but he would have to face the three capos murder in 1987. They basically go to court. And Michael Chertoff, the prosecutor, would call Joe Mussino the Horatio Alger of the mob. So you know a lot about Horatio Alger, Blackjack. Why was he called that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Horatio Alger was an author in the 1800s in America who specialized in writing stories about kind of like bootstrap stories, right? Like kids who would come from really humble and bad beginnings and manage to pull themselves up and make something of themselves through all different means, right? It was kind of, you know, it's just stories of people making something out of nothing. And I think that when Chertoff says that about Mussino in his opening statement, he's talking about Mussino's rise, right? I mean, Mussino had a very rapid rise in this family from the time he was inducted to where he is in 1986 as essentially the street boss of this family. I mean, we all know Restelli is the boss in title, but Mussino is running this thing on the street, and he's done this in less than 10 years. It really is an incredible story.
Yeah, by this point, Joe Mussino is in his 40s. Joe Mussino is, I've always said this, you know, if I had to make another list of guys that looked like complete mobsters, Joe Mussino would be at the top of the list. And Joe Mussino is it's funny enough, Blackjack, when I met Dave Portner for the first time, he told me I was
straight out of Central Casting.
Yes, exactly what you would think of when you think of a gambler. And when you think of a mobster, Joe Messina was Central Casting. I mean, he had the slick back hair. He was about 350 pounds. All he wore was tracksuits. Like he was, you know, he was closing Ostrom, man. That Joe Messina, you know, was you know, a P. And look, calling him Horatio Agar was an exact truth. The good thing for Joe Messina for Sal Vitale in this case was they were actually cleared of the murder conspiracy charges, which was big because, look, a murder conspiracy can get you 20 to life. Hijacking charges, you're going to get a couple of years, and that's going to be that. So Joe Messina gets convicted of that, and he goes down to federal prison in 1986. Sal Vitale manages to beat the rap, and he basically is the messenger alongside Joe Messina and Anthony Spiro, who's also
the interesting thing about his trial too is not only could they not tie the murder to him, but the RICO charges he beat as well in what is what I think is one of the most unique defenses you could put forward, which was essentially that there was a criminal enterprise going on, but Joe Messina wasn't the boss of this family. It's Ristelli. And so he couldn't have benefited from the organization's criminal enterprises. And the jury bought that. Like they fucking bought that, which is a wild defense to throw out there.
Yeah, and it worked out, seemingly, as you said. In 1991, basically right before Philip Ristelli dies, Philip Ristelli died in late 1991. Joe Messina is basically made boss after Anthony Spiro calls a meeting of the family capos and basically realizes, everybody realizes, look, Joe has put this family through two wild upheaval attempts. Joe has taken us through the Donnie Brasco fiasco. Joe Messina is the boss. He was elected unopposed. And when he was released in November 1992, Joseph Messina is named boss of the Bonanno crime family. He finally gets to the top of the mountain, and he names his brother-in-law, Salvatore Vitale, as his underboss. Spiro and others continue as capos. And Spiro had his own. We'll do a show on Spiro as well. He was a fascinating cat as well. They return to their job at the catering companies, and Joe actually owns a restaurant by this point as well called Casablanca, which I believe still is actually around. I think it's another name, which maybe down the road, if we get the right things to go our way, Blackjack, maybe we'll go have a dinner at this place. And
it is still there, by the way.
Very good. It's right in Maspeth. Now, not only was Joe Messina a smart guy, but Joe Messina realized that he was not going to, again, make the same mistakes as some of his counterparts. He knew John Gotti. He knew, you know, Gigante. He knew these guys. And, you know, while Gigante was smart, the crazy ruse was not, I think, a competent way, at least late in his life, to get through things. So Joe, in being one of the final guys to be out there as the last boss, basically, Joe started instituting rules in the family that were pretty serious. If you fucked with them, you were going to go, basically. One of the rules was to never say his name out loud. And they would also give him the nickname The Ear, because anytime a Joe Messina would have you reference him, you would be asked to touch your ear. And again, Chin Gigante did it with his chin. That's why they called him Chin, basically. And it was a good tactic. Now, he also did other things. He basically outlawed social clubs, so JNS Cake was gone. Social clubs are havens for wiretaps, for surveillance. If you look at the Bergadot and Fish Club, if you look at the Palma Boys Social Club, you look at the Raven Eye, any social club, they were not only havens for the FBI, but Rosemary and Thomas Uva would also prove later that they were also breeding grounds for robberies. People would, there was always stuff going on at social clubs. And Joe Messina realized that, like funerals, they were bad things to go to if you were a mobster. He would also arrange family meetings to be conducted in remote areas, even sometimes in foreign countries, which he took major steps to avoid things. He also remembered that Joe Pistone basically got involved with the family because he was, you know, basically allowed to do what he wanted to do. He basically would decree that all prospective made men would have to have a working relationship with a member of the mob for at least 8 years before becoming made. So yeah, you would have to put work in for a long time. And it was a smart thing to do, Blackjack, because you would ensure people were reliable.
The protocols that he put in are a testament to how intelligent he was. Like we talked earlier about, you know, if he would have led a different life, what he could have done. This stuff makes so much sense in hindsight. You know, the ear thing is a beautiful tactic, right? To just avoid saying your name. The other person knows what you're talking about and nobody can pick it up. The social clubs were a disaster because all you would have to do is find one guy who had been convicted of an organized crime activity. And now all of a sudden you can tie everyone in, right? Because now it's part of a racketeering issue. And then moving to other countries, the 8 years thing. With the 8 years rule, you can't get a government informant to infiltrate. No one is investing 8 years of their life just to get in the door.
Yeah, so it wasn't just 8 years too. They're probably doing some background on these people.
Exactly. What he did was just, it was meant to protect the family, right? And when we said that he was the last of the true gangsters, that's what we mean. It's like this guy would do whatever he had to do to protect his organization.
Yeah, and a lot of that was echoed by people of stature. By this point, Joe Pistone, Jerry Capisci, who's a mob writer, they would actually refer to Joe as one of the last of the old-time gangsters. Joe would also encourage his men to have their sons made as well. In Joe Messina's view, that would make it less likely for a capo to turn informant, since if they would do that, their son would be in harm's way. So, you know, Joe was willing to do everything. He also created a different system for emissaries to communicate with others. He was just super interested in making sure that he didn't make the same mistakes as others. Now, Joe Messina would, though, develop some issues. There started to be a little bit of a problem with his brother-in-law, Salvatore Vitale. Now, you know, Sal Vitale is a really interesting guy because I think one thing that always made me interested in Vitale was that he really never did any prison time, weirdly enough, which I think is definitely a concern. There have been rumors, nothing has ever been proven, but there have been rumors that Salvatore Vitale was a police officer the whole time. I don't know how true that is. I don't think it is, but Sal Vitale was a guy that had unusually good luck with skating on things. Mm-hmm. But by this point, Sal Vitale was using his role, because I think a lot of people realize Sal Vitale was a mobster, but he got a lot of where he was because of who his brother-in-law was. Yep. And, you know, people in the family started to get sick of his nonsense. He was overstepping. He would always kind of pull the, you know who my brother-in-law is kind of stuff. And yep. People get sick of that stuff, especially when they're busting their ass for a dollar and you got this guy, you know, it's kind of like the rich kid, you know, it's like, shut the fuck up, man. Like,
yeah. I mean, I think when you mentioned the prison thing, that is, you know, we talked earlier about how, like, sometimes you gotta get your hands dirty to make your bones. I think the real test, and we talked about this with Jimmy Burke last week, is can you hold up to time, right? Like, can you stand there, face it, take it, and come out the way you went in? And it's odd that Vitale never had that. Like, it's in all of these stories we tell, everyone goes away for some amount of time.
Yeah, and it was always a wonder as to why Vitale was so easy to, like, do the things that he did. And it kind of does make some sense. So Joe Messina, who didn't really want to make any waves, goes to Vitale kind of, I'm sure, like a family party, and says, hey, let me bend your ear for a little bit. Look, people are getting sick of your antics and behavior. I'm going to pull back a little bit, and people are sick of you. And I'm going to kind of get some other people involved. I think Sal Vitale, that was the first real crack that developed between him and Joe Messina. He took it as a slight. Vitale was loyal, though. Obviously he was family, and he continues to help Joe Messina run the day-to-day. In 1999, Joe Messina murders and sets up a murder on a guy called Orlando Siassa. Siassa was a capo regime in the Montreal crime family, and he had been involved in some hits and things of that nature. He becomes in a beef with a confidant of Joe Mussino, a capo called Anthony Graziano. Anthony Graziano was a big-time capo. He was a longtime friend to Joe, and he was a drug dealer. And Siasa starts basically saying that, you know, Graziano is a cokehead and this and that. And, you know, you're not going to do that. Graziano at this point is a respected guy. He'd been with Joe Mussino really from the beginning, and he's an old timer, and you're not going to talk about him like that. So he goes to Joe Mussino and says, this guy's got to go. And Joe Mussino obliges, and they get rid of him. Now, it's interesting because Graziano is actually connected to today. If you remember Blackjack, the show Mob Wives, do you know that show?
I do.
Yeah, so the character Renee, this is her father, TG, Tony. And he actually disowned her over the show. Keep in mind, years later, Tony Graziano was indicted on racketeering charges after Renee's husband, Hector Pagan, who was a Puerto Rican. He was an associate of the Bonanno crime family. He basically flips and gives up Graziano. So, you know, weirdly enough, his daughters made a whole ton of money off of his name. But yeah, so he's a friend of Mussino, and Siasa is killed. Now, this would also set up a crack for Siasa and the, you know, Joe Mussino faction, because, you know, Siasa was connected to Montreal, which had a longstanding relationship with Joe Mussino and the Bonannos. Now, after becoming boss, there was kind of a thought that Joe Mussino would move to have the name renamed to the Mussino crime family. They were kind of sick of Joe Bonanno and that namesake, and they wanted kind of a change of name.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, Joe Bonanno wrote a controversial book, ironically called A Man of Honor, which tells you a lot about people who give themselves that title. And I think that really rubbed Mussino the wrong way, that you're gonna write a book and profit off of exposing the life that that Mussino has spent his entire life protecting. So I think it rubbed him the wrong way. But at the end of the day, Jeff, I don't think anybody except Joe Mussino took that name change seriously.
Yeah, and by this point, if you remember, I kind of talked about the Bonanno crime family has always been kind of the odd group out. They hadn't been on the commission since the 60s.
They're like the bastard child.
Yeah, they hadn't been involved with the commission. And John Gotti tries to do something to get them back on the commission by kind of overstepping and saying, look, we should get Joe and the Bonannos on the commission again. Joe, weirdly enough, takes it as like a slight, basically, like, why are you doing that? I didn't ask you to do that. And then a crack develops. But he would kind of get, you know, the commission would kind of reverse some decisions and get them involved. But by this point, Joe was the only boss in the Fine Families that was not in prison. And they were considered the most powerful mob in New York. And as I said, a crack had also developed between Joe Mussino and the Rizzutos, which would last really until the end. Joe also, by this point, was enjoying the fruits of the FBI going after other families. The FBI basically said, we care more about the Colombos who were in a war and the Gambinos because they hated John Gotti, that they weren't worrying about the Bonanno crime family. So for large parts of the 90s, the Bonanno crime family did their thing. They weren't really bucked around with
I mean, again, you look at Gotti, right, and the attention that he not only brought but welcomed on that family. He rubbed the feds' faces in it every time he beat them. You know, he's on the front page of the newspapers as often as he can be. You know, you're talking about the guy who's on the front page, the cover of Time magazine. And Joe Mussino had the complete opposite approach, right? It was shut up and lay low. And yeah, that tends to work, right? I mean, if you just go about your business and stay quiet and stay under the radar, more often than not, they're going to leave you alone for a while.
Yeah, and Joe Mussino was happily okay with just letting everyone else get knocked off. And, you know, I'll just continue to do what we do. By 1995, though, the FBI, as we know by the great show, The Wire. Prop Joe said it best. The only thing that bothers cops is bullets and liquor, basically. The only other thing would be boredom. They just can't live with that shit. So when cops get bored, they start looking around and they start targeting the Bonanno administration. In 1995, Anthony Spiro is given 2 years for loan sharking. He then is subsequently in 2002 given life imprisonment for murder. We'll talk about why that happened. Some of the Bath Avenue crew, they were involved with that. We'll get into them down the road. Graziano, he would assume Spiro's duties, but he would be arrested in 2002 as well. And Salvatore Vitale, Joe's brother-in-law, would also plead guilty to loan sharking. But for whatever reason, he was given house arrest.
Yeah, that's another interesting note with Sal Vitale. And the other note you can take is that 2002 was a fucking awful year for the Bonanno family.
It really was. But Joe could point out a positive. Up until 2002, the Bonanno crime family could say they had not one member become a rat, which was a pretty lofty thing, frankly, because every other family had Gravano and Peter Savino and little Al Diarco and, you know, all Mikey DiLeonardo, all these.
It's crazy, you know, that they didn't have one person. And Messina was incredibly proud of that.
But as usual in Joe Messina's life, doesn't last forever. In 2002, Joe is crowing about it. And Frank Coppa Sr., the man who was involved with the Sonny Black Napolitano hit and that kind of stuff, he's convicted of fraud and other charges, and he decides to start singing. Shortly after, Richard Cantarella, a participant in the Anthony Mira murder for the Donnie Brasco stuff, he gets arrested for that murder and racketeering. And then Joseph D'Amico is also arrested, and he turns rat after a murder as well. So,
yeah, again, you can't convince me that Sal Vitale wasn't cooperating. I mean, think about it, Jeff. You've got the brother-in-law of the boss of the last remaining family, you know, of real importance in New York. You get him. You get him, and instead of sentencing him right away after his conviction, you put him on house arrest. That screams cooperation.
Yeah, and by this point in 2002, the wheels start to fall off for Joseph Messina, and this was really kind of the beginning of the end. By these people being arrested one after another, this left Joe pretty vulnerable. And on January 9, 2003, right at the beginning of the new year, Joseph Messina is arrested and indicted alongside his brother-in-law, Sal Vitale, Frank Lino, and a cop of regime, Daniel Mangelli, in a big-time racketeering indictment. Basically, the charges would include the murder of Sonny Black Napolitano, and Messina is denied bail. So he's not getting out this time. He's got to remain in holding. At that point, Vinnie Gorgeous Bassiano takes over as the acting boss in Joe's absence.
Tell everyone why his name is Vinnie Gorgeous.
Yeah, so, you know, Vinnie Gorgeous is an interesting guy. He's a guy that is locked up currently, but Vinnie Gorgeous was a guy that owned hair salons. He was a guy that owned a barbershop, or not a barbershop, beauty salon in the Bronx called Hello Gorgeous. And he would, he was actually a good looking guy. Always had coiffed hair and perfectly groomed, dressed well, good looking. It's the show of lists. I mean, if you're asking, you know, the best looking mob guys, Vinnie Bassiano would probably be in there. He's a good looking guy. They called him Vinnie Gorgeous. He was a hair guy. Yeah, so that's why
you would say he was the Jeff Nadeau of the mafia.
Yes, he had great hair. He was good looking, as I am. But yeah, he was also a pretty big lunatic as well, and he would kill people. So now it just keeps getting worse for Joe Messina. During this whole imprisonment and trial, three more Bonanno made men would decide to cooperate. The first was a guy called James Tartaglione. And then he decides to basically wear a wire after remaining free. One of the other folks that become informants as well is a name that is familiar to Joe Massino, Salvatore Vitale. So again, let me repeat that. Yes, Joe Massino's brother-in-law, a guy he's known since he was 16 years old and pretty much gave him everything he had, decides to cooperate. And again, I will continue to contend. I don't think this is when Sal Vitale started to cooperate. I think Sal Vitale was cooperating a long time before this. And this just kind of added to it being out there. Now, if you remember, Joe cut back Sal's duties. I think even at one point contemplated killing him, probably would have been in his best interest, because it ended up proving vital in what happened to Joe Massino. Basically, Sal Vitale was quoted as saying that he became dissatisfied by the lack of support he got, and that Joe Massino basically screwed him, basically, and said that he was gonna go in turn to believe people that weren't his family instead of him. Others started to cooperate as well, including a longtime associate, Dwayne Leisenheimer. So Joe Massino, everything was falling out. And he was basically looking down the barrel at life in prison. With all the defections, Joe Massino is hit even harder. He's charged with 7 more murders, including the 3 capos, Anthony Mira, Cesar Bonaventure, Gabriel Infante, and Orlando Siasa, the guy that called Graziano a cokehead. Interestingly enough, the Siasa hit was the bad one because it took place after 1994. Now, as you know, Blackjack, in 1994, there was an amendment to the racketeering laws that if you committed murder in aid of racketeering, you could be eligible for the death penalty.
Correct.
Now, it's important to discuss, in the history of the mob, no mobster has ever been put to death, ever. It's never happened. No. And as you know, you're a lawyer, it's very tough to give someone the death penalty.
It's hard. It's really hard, right? Like, and it's hard because I think with mafia people in particular, it's tough to get 12 jurors to vote to execute somebody when the reality is almost none of these murders are people who have clean hands, right? It's not someone committing a random murder. It's a murder of somebody else who was in organized crime or somebody who was dealing with organized crime. You don't have the aggravating factors that are necessary to create a death sentence. However, you know, this was the Bush administration, W. Bush, John Ashcroft's the attorney general. John Ashcroft was a hard ass, and they were legitimately considering pursuing the death penalty on Joe Massino. I mean, it was not off the table by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, and Joe Massino, you know, at this point is, in his 60s. He basically realizes that everything's over. So the trial would begin on May 24th, 2004, and the prosecution would present basically 11 RICO counts for 7 murders, arson, extortion, loan sharking, illegal gambling, and money laundering. Basically, a potpourri of mob charges.
Fucking law.
Yeah. By this point, Time Magazine releases a magazine dubbing Massino as the last Don in reference to his status as the only New York boss to evade conviction up to that point. And as we know, the name would stick. Interestingly enough, some things, at least Joe Massino thought, maybe went his way. Sal Vitale was the last of the 6 to take the stand. And this was obviously really significant to the case. Salvatore Vitale could basically blueprint the entire criminal life of Joe Massino, basically starting from the lunch truck all the way up to the end. And the problem for Joe Massino is he really had no defense. I mean, no one could really question anybody's reliability. And his defense was also unusual in that he made no attempt to contest that Massino was the boss, but instead stressing the murders in the case took place before he took over and that Massino himself showed a love of life because the murders ceased.
Dude, I can't tell you. We've talked about a lot of people on this show who have turned state's evidence. Sal Vitale might be the biggest scumbag that we've discussed. Dude, how do you do this to your sister's husband of 43 years?
Yeah, and really like, the guy that gave you the life.
How do you do that?
Right. Yeah.
And can you imagine, we both have sisters. Like, can you imagine doing this to your sister's husband of 43 years?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I would say the one that's always gotten me was this one. There's another one in Chicago. If you know about it, it's called the Family Secrets Trial. Frank Calabrese Jr. testifies against his own father, Frank Calabrese Sr. But you can make the contention, Frank Calabrese Sr. was a terrible father. He basically told his son that if he left the mob, he'd kill him. And again, I guess you could make some sort of case, but yeah, this was a really scummy move. I mean, Sal Vitale was a bad dude.
Well, everything Sal Vitale had in his life was because of Joe Mussino.
Yes. And yeah, I mean, he put his sister in a bad spot. I mean, it was just really ugly stuff, but look, rats are shit bags. I mean, that's what they do. After 5 days of deliberation, the jury on July 30, 2004, would find Joe Mussino guilty on every count. The charges stuck, including all seven murders. The jury also approved the prosecutor's recommended $10 million forfeiture of Joe Mussino's reign as boss. So you have to remember, I mean, Joe Mussino was a rich man, but $10 million is a lot.
It's a lot of money.
And again, as you know, they do allocutions and they're going to take as much as they can. And if you've watched The Sopranos, Johnny Sack went through an allocution when Bernie Madoff was, I mean, they took everything Bernie Madoff had. His wife was living in a fucking one bedroom apartment at the end of it. Keep in mind, Bernie Madoff was a billionaire. Okay. Yep. So again, I mean, Joe Mussino had to really look at the fact that he was going to go to jail, maybe go to the chair, and his wife, who he was with since he was 16, he loved her to the moon. She was going to be affected by this.
And her brother had just done this to her as well. So now her entire family dynamic is just fucked.
Yeah. And look, at the end of the day, I think you could say one thing about Josephine Mussino. She knew what was going on. I mean, she's not stupid. Immediately after Joe is found guilty and convicted on right after July 30th, Joe Mussino basically requests to speak with the judge, which is definitely interesting.
Highly unusual.
Yes. At that point, Joseph Mussino does something that has never been done in the history of this country and in criminal mob circles. Joe Mussino decides that he wants to cooperate. And I'm sure you're probably asking, what would he cooperate against? Because he's the main cheese, if you will. But Joe Mussino wants to avoid the death penalty. And if found guilty of the Siassa murder, he would have faced it. And one of John Ashcroft's final acts as attorney general was to order federal prosecutors to seek the death penalty for Joe Mussino. As you said, Ashcroft was a tough dude. He didn't want Mussino to get off. And Joe Mussino would face death.
Yeah, and we're in a post 9/11 world. Like, you have to remember that too. This is 03, like 03, 04. We're in a post 9/11 world. Law enforcement is strict. We're prosecuting people very harshly on the federal level. And yeah, I mean, it's not out of the realm that they would have, that the needle is on the table here.
Yeah, I mean, back in the 90s, I mean, they were really prosecuting hard. I mean, today it's different because if you look at the federal inmate population now, I think it's like 8% are violent offenders, which is crazy. They don't prosecute, I think, the way they used to. But when you look at Joe cooperating, he claimed that he decided to turn informant because it was only about his wife and mother. He didn't want them to have to live in squalor and forfeit their houses and make it worse. And you know, other authors like Selwyn Rabb and Anthony DiStefano would both say that they felt as if Joe Mussino had kind of gotten sick and grew disillusioned with the mob. So many people were flipping. I think up until 2002, he was all about the mob and everything was going well for Joe Mussino, but then everything started to fall apart. Everything happened at the worst time. And I think Joe kind of said to himself, what the fuck am I doing this for? Why am I going to get the chair and my wife's going to lose everything? for what exactly?
Yeah. And I think that that's the best point. It's like, first of all, you know, we've said many times on this show that neither one of us has a lot of respect for people who turn state's evidence. But his level of cooperation was very low. And if I'm him, to be honest with you, it isn't like he got popped and turned around and said, hey, let me cut a deal. He had a handful of people turn on him and were perfectly willing to stick the needle in his arm. So at that point, brother, I don't think you owe them a damn bit of loyalty.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think every informant situation is different. I think there are people that when you look at them and say, well, do you get it? Kind of, I do in this situation.
I get it with him just because it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't because he was afraid of going to prison. It wasn't because he wanted to save his own hide. He still knew he was going to die in prison. Like, he still knew that he was going to go to prison for, you know,
I think a long time.
He wanted to try to salvage something for his family.
I think at the end of the day, though, Joe Mussino, like most of us thought he was a gangster. And John Gotti said it best. You either die, you either go out one or two ways, in a body bag or jail. We don't retire. You know, it doesn't really work like that. And, you know, I think Joe kind of said, you know what, I'm not going to do it. He could obviously level up and give them some things that they wanted, and he cooperated. After the advice, basically at this point, some things came down. What the FBI wanted was they wanted to know where the three capos were. They wanted to know where John Favara was, the guy who killed Gotti's son accidentally. There were a lot of bodies that weren't found. You know, Favara, Tommy DeSimone. Nobody knew where he was. They didn't know where the three capos were. They wanted to settle the scores and figure out where they were. So Joe Mussino would obviously help them get that stuff. They would also get a murder that Joe Mussino was able to get out of Vinnie Gorgeous Basciano that he conspired to kill a federal prosecutor. So Basciano's arrested and they get some stuff out of it. They also recorded Vincent Basciano freely admitting to murdering an associate, Randolph Pozzola. By the end of 2005, Basciano is indicted for the Pozzola murder, and Mussino is identified as the news source, as then an anonymous mobster who secretly recorded the conversation and to the public disgust of the family. So the defection was out there. People knew. In that year, the Justice Department dropped the threat of the death penalty regarding the murder of Siasa. And in June 2005, Joe Mussino finalized his deal and pled guilty to ordering that Siasa murder. For this and the 2004 conviction, he was sentenced to life imprisonment with a possible reduction depending on his service as a witness. So not only was Joe Mussino not going to die in the chair, he also was likely not going to die in prison. And to make one better, he was also probably going to get to live his life with his wife on the outside. The same day, his wife, Josephine, negotiated a settlement to satisfy the forfeiture claim, keeping the names of not only her house, but Joseph's mother's house out of the indictment as well as rental properties, while turning over some things, including $7 million, some gold bars, and the restaurant called Casablanca. Interestingly enough, Joe Mussino was absent from the prosecution witness chair in the trial of Basciano. The prosecution decided that it had what they needed, and they didn't need Joe Mussino. Yep. But he did and was expected to testify against Vito Rizzuto regarding his role in that three capos murder. Rizzuto was a shooter in that case. Until Rizzuto accepted a plea bargain. Mussino would testify in the Pozzola trial for Basciano, and Basciano was indeed convicted. To this day, Vincent Basciano is still in prison. He's in for life. And there was actually some news recently. Vincent Basciano was actually at the ADX, the Supermax. Mm-hmm. Then he went over to Florence. Then he went to Big Sandy, which is arguably one of the worst prisons in America. Up until recently, Vinny Gore just got some good news, though. He was moved to USP Atlanta, so he's got a medium now. He can move around a little bit, see his family a little bit more. So, yeah, Vincent Basciano is still in prison, and he won't get out.
Yeah, I mean, he's not getting out. I mean, they tried to get the death penalty on him, and they couldn't get it, largely for the reasons we talked about earlier with Massino. But they did attempt the death penalty on him. And the interesting thing about Massino, too, is that they continued to use him to testify as basically like an expert witness on the American mafia, like kind of just the workings of the organization. So, you know, he provided some use to the federal government. I don't know that he gave them a ton in exchange for what he got, which, if we're being honest, Jeff, he kind of got a great deal, because this is a guy who was staring down the barrel of a lethal injection, certainly life in prison, and managed to secure the possibility of parole and keeping his wife and mother's property in their names. It's not a bad deal for what he gave them, because he didn't give them a hell of a lot.
Yeah, and at the end of his testimony, Joseph Massino is noted as saying, "I'm hoping to see a light at the end of the tunnel." Joe would get that in 2013 after basically a couple of years behind bars. He was set to be released from prison. He had served 12 years of a life sentence for 8 murder counts, which, pretty damn good, as they say. One usually gets you life, so I'll tell you what 8 gets you. Keep in mind, Joseph Massino is still alive, as far as I know.
Somewhere.
And he is using a name that we don't know in the Witness Protection Program. I have heard rumblings that Joseph Massino is living in Florida somewhere.
You want me to try to track him down?
Yeah, maybe he lives next door to you.
He could be a neighbor of mine. There's a lot of old people down here.
Yeah, it's interesting that nowadays, I guess there's not a lot of people doing shows like this, so no one really knows who Joe is at this point. But, I mean, Joseph Massino is 78 years old. He's an old man. There are two things I wonder about Joe Massino at this point. What is his relationship like with Salvatore Vitale? Because
none.
Salvatore Vitale is still alive as well. And he's out there as well. They had a long life together. They're both informants at the end of the day. Do they speak?
You have to wonder. I can tell you, if it's me, the answer is absolutely not. That guy caused so many problems and pain for not only, and this is where, to me, the line would be, you do what you want, but like to do what he did to his sister and his, you know, to Massino's kids. Nah, dude, fuck you. Like, I want nothing to do with you. Nothing. I think if Joe Massino saw Sal Vitale on the street, he'd kill him on the street.
I will say this. If you asked me, if you could interview one person, who would you pick? It would be Joe Massino. For sure. Because one thing we've seen over the last 3 to 5 years is every rat that has a story has a YouTube channel now, right?
Yep.
And there are some people like Joseph Massino that have basically disappeared.
I don't think he's proud of what he did. Like, I don't think it's I don't think he did it. Like, you talk about these guys. We talk about them all the time, like Gravano and Franzis and you know, these guys, Elite. And these guys have made themselves into celebrities off of doing what they did. I think Joe Massino, if you got him alone in a room and put a drink or two in him, he'd probably tell you it was the worst moment of his life.
Yeah, and that's one thing about Joe Massino that I will say that I do respect about him. I mean, he hasn't come out of his hole. I mean, I think he's just realized, you know, I have kids. He probably has grandkids at this point. Yeah, I'm just going to live out the rest of my life. I think you're dead right. I think Joe Massino, when he looks back at his life, I think he's proud of what he was able to do. He was a gangster. At the end of the day, Joe Massino cooperated because he, I think, really just wanted to not die in the chair. And
I don't even know it's that, Jeff. When we talk about the mafia, we throw the word family around a lot, right? Like, they call it a family. But you see, when the rubber meets the road, a lot of guys don't view it as a family because you're out to save your own skin, right? Like, you wouldn't do that to your own family, right? Like, there's not a circumstance where you would testify against your mother or father in a courtroom. These guys who are these fucking rats, they don't view it that way. And I think Massino looked at it and said, listen, these guys who I considered family, five or six of them turned against me, and my actual family, my wife of 43 years and my kids and my mother are going to suffer for this. No, the loyalty is to your family.
Yeah. And again, Joe Mussina's out there somewhere. And he's an old man at this point. I would love to talk to him if he wants to talk to me. But I won't hold my breath. I will say
Joe's listening to podcasts.
Yeah. I will say two things, kind of wrapping up the Joe Mussina show. And then I'll just kind of talk about something personal that I have about Joe Mussina. Interestingly enough, the Bonanno crime family didn't name another boss until 2013. And according to the federal government, not according to me, allegedly there is a new boss, according to them. It's a headless snake, the mob now. It's not like it once was. It's still out there, but they finally have a new boss for a couple of years now. I will say this about Joe Mussina as we end this. It's been a long show. Joe Mussina is a rigid and complicated guy. It's weird because when I first found out about Joe Mussina, I remember watching something on him. And for a long time, Joe Mussina was one of my favorite mobsters in the history of organized crime. And then I found out he cooperated, and that definitely bothered me, especially when I was younger. Cause I like, you know, I'm not going to say I like rats or anything. I don't like them. I think they're stool pigeons, and I think they should go to jail for things that they've done and not rat everybody out. But I don't know. Joe Mussina always, I always say this about him. He was an interesting guy. He was a smart guy. I have to wonder where he would be if he didn't go into the mob. Yep. I think he would have been a really rich guy regardless of what he did.
Would have been a great businessman.
Yeah. This is definitely a show that I enjoyed doing because I think Joe Mussina is really fascinating, man. He went through a lot as a boss. You got to remember, he was a boss for a long time. I mean, he was boss basically from the 1980s into the 2000s.
Yeah. It's a long time. It's a
considering
long
Gotti was boss for like 4 years. I mean, it's 6 years. It's pretty crazy. So, yeah. He kind of had that Carlo, you know, Gambino. He was a boss for a long time. So,
yep, you're right.
And we'll remember Joe Mussina as the last true mob boss, really right until the end. So there you go. Joe Mussina. Probably my favorite show we did. I always say that every week, but I really like the Joe Mussina topic, and I think it's fascinating. So there you go. I hope you enjoyed. Next week we will get into another fascinating individual, Craig the Grim Reaper Scarpa, one of the great nicknames in mob history, the Grim Reaper.
Yeah.
Big Joey, that's not really a great nickname. Fit in, but it wasn't that good. So we'll talk about that next week. Before we go, I want to tell you all, thank you for listening. Thank you for checking us out. If there's someone you want us to talk about, make sure you hit us up. We're really going to just keep firing on this. Maybe this gets elevated and take it somewhere else. We'll see. But I've enjoyed doing it, and I'm glad we're able to bring it to you. This has been The Sit Down. I am Jeff Nadeau. He is Blackjack Fletcher. Make sure you go follow us on Twitter at The Sit Down 7. You can also, when you check out the show, make sure you hit the subscribe button so you never miss an episode. Make sure you let us know what you think of the show. Give us 5 stars. You can find it on all podcast platforms. Have a great night, everybody. Thanks for watching. It's been Joe Mussina. We'll see you next week here on The Sit Down.